Welcome to Nature Now, an original production by KPTZ volunteers. Nature Now is a program of information and insights about the natural history of our region. We welcome observations and suggestions from our listeners, care of Nature Now at kptz.org.
Hello, this is Debron Kelso, host of this edition of Nature Now for the first week of April. And this week, we're very pleased to have for you part two of our fascinating conversation with Dr. Jeff Hammerson about bird migration, which was recorded last year. And as an extra bonus, we have Fred Sharp here to help me share observations of the past week and discuss the mystery sound. Welcome, Fred.
Hey, everybody.
One really good thing to come out of this stay-at-home order is seeing the increase in the number of people out walking and enjoying the natural wonders in their very own backyards. And it couldn't have come at a better time of the year with increase in sunlight and flowers blooming and new birds arriving daily, either to stay and breed or migrate to our area on their way north. So, Fred, what have you been seeing out there?
Well, I see the first of the trilliums are poking their beautiful three-petaled blossoms up through the forest duff. They're looking fabulous. And, of course, our classic species, the red-flowered currant, the hazel catkins are elongating. Same with the alders. They're turning beautiful colors now. The coltsfoot is up all over the bluffs. Sweet coltsfoot. Their big white flowers and large palmate leaves are putting on a great show right now. Also, the shepherdia, the buffalo berry, that beautiful rusty shrub with rusty leaves.
It's more of an east side species, and we don't see it very often here. I love it, but it likes kind of poor soils, and it likes sunny areas, right?
Yeah, dry, sunny spots. You can see it on kind of the open glacial bluffs around the Quimper Peninsula. Locally, it can get fairly common there, being one of the dominant shrubs. It has a tart red berry that will be out in early summer. They're very favored food of the Native American tribes.
Well, it's also called soapberry, right?
That's right. How do they prepare those? Did they make some kind of frothy?
A slurry, but with salal berries, the sweetened.
Yeah, sweetened salal berries or camas syrup, and kind of like a delicious dessert item. So those are out and blooming in full profusion right now if you get out on our drier bluffs. My friend Shane from Port Angeles sent me a beautiful picture of a large stonefly, an adult stonefly, that they're creeping up out of our creeks and waterways now.
And they were giant. I mean, and they look like, they're really cool looking.
Yeah, big looking insect, maybe up to 2.5 inches, 3 inches long, long antennae, dark eyes, and our species has a beautiful yellow collar around the neck, and they're emerging out of the waterways. They're a very important insect in that they are good indicators of ecosystem health. In rivers that have been overly disturbed or have any acidification, they disappear very quickly. So it's great to having this indicator of ecosystem health popping up.
Yes, indeed. And also we're starting to see some shorebirds. I saw two spotted sandpipers in non-breeding plumage out on my coast survey, just last week, just a few days ago. We were noticing that there are so few other birds on the water, right?
Some of the studies have shown that most of our marine saltwater ducks are decreasing in their abundance over the past couple of decades. We should be seeing a lot more birds this time of year, staging and pre-breeding behaviors, prenuptial behaviors. That's been one of the challenges with the Salish Sea is losing our sea duck population. But there is great news in that the Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife surveys for herring spawn in Discovery Bay and Squim Bay have shown near record levels of spawn.
There was a nice article in last week's Leader about that. The milky cast to the waters is due to herring spawn.
So it's pretty neat. So that's exactly what our sea ducks need, is these abundant, healthy populations of forage fish. So, yeah, we're optimistic. Over the next several years, these herring, they can grow up to be 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 years old, and they feed a myriad of different species, including salmon, sharks, whales, dolphins, all manner of predatory bottom fishes. So pleased to have a strong year class of herring coming up.
And another note is watch for newts crossing the road. It's peak newt migration. They're migrating to the ponds to breed, and they move so slowly across the roads that you have to be really vigilant for them. The other good thing about this stay-at-home edict is that there aren't so many vehicles on the roads to mash the newts, so they have a better chance of crossing the roads in good health.
Yeah, they really don't like snow tires.
Yeah. Newts are lovely beings, but they're pretty slow crossing the road. So be extra vigilant for moving shapes. They're brown on the overside, can blend in with the roads easily. On the underside, they're bright orange, their warning coloration. But they are very lovely creatures that we have, and we should guard them well. And here's our mystery sound of the week. I chose this as mystery sound this week because I've been hearing this sound everywhere in my neighborhood this spring, more than ever before in the last 30 years. We'll play it again at the end of the program and tell you what it is. And now on to part two of our interview with Dr. Jeff Hammerson about the wonders of bird migration.
So what's the latest thinking on how birds find their way? I mean, is it by the stars, magnetic fields? Is it something that's genetically programmed or something that they learn from others?
All right, well, let's start with an easy example to
Let's do that.
Since it gets really complicated quickly yes. when we ask how birds do this. How do they find their way? Think of geese, for example. Geese find the way. Young geese, how do they know where to go? They follow their parents. That's simple as that. They have a instinctive urge to follow their parents. And so they do. They stick with their parents through that migration southward, and they learn the way, and they remember it.
Can you imagine that? Can you imagine learning the way, I mean, that far with just one take?
Yeah, one take, yeah. That's all it takes. But then let's compare that to something like Western sandpiper. It's the most abundant shorebird on our Pacific coast here. They nest most of them up in Western Alaska. All right, so the parents are done nesting, and then they take off. They leave. And the juveniles that have just been raised stay around for a while, feeding some more, but they're left. They're abandoned. Mom and dad take off and head south a month before the juveniles do. And then the juveniles make their first migration, no parental guidance at all.
Wow.
They find their way to an appropriate habitat. Well, how do they do that? Well, they have instinctive, genetically programmed responses to cues that are available to them. For example, which way to go? They know which way to go just inherently. It's programmed into their genetic makeup. So they know in the fall they're going to go south. And how do they know which way is south? Well, they have an instinctive response to compass cues or directional cues that are out there, like the sun. We can use that as a compass, so can birds. The night sky, the stars in the sky, for example, we can use that as a directional compass, and so can birds. And something that we can't use so readily just without help, without devices, is the Earth's magnetic field. And birds can sense that. And they actually have in their eyes molecules that are sensitive to geomagnetism.
You were describing that to me, and I didn't realize that. That's just so amazing. Like from the air, we see topographic lines, but they see it in magnetic fields.
Yeah, it gets complicated really fast as to exactly how they're perceiving it, but it apparently functions as a visual cue, the Earth's magnetic field, so that we look over the landscape and see a topography, and so do birds. They actually use those mountain ranges and rivers and coastlines to help them on their migrations, but also they can perceive the Earth's magnetic field, and they can perceive it as a map, not only directionally, so they can tell which way is north and south, and they respond instinctively as with seasons as to which way to go. But also, once they make a migration, They're following this topography, this magnetic, geomagnetic topography as well, and learning it and using it for their later migrations as a map, because they remember all this. This is the weird thing is that they do it once and they, oh, okay, I got it. And they can go back. In fact,
you're just about to tell me some amazing stories of how they go back to the exact same place, right?
Yeah, it's not a very generalized kind of navigation system. It's very specific. In fact, most of the birds that make long-distance migrations end up going to, in subsequent years, the same places they were the previous year, whether it be to spend the winter. It might be the same beach in Panama, or the same shoreline in Peru, or the same island in Chile, and the same beach on the same island in Chile.
Wow.
And then they'll end up back, let's say, in a nesting area in Alaska or somewhere far in the far north that is just the same place where they were the year before. In fact, some of the tracking devices that people use nowadays to find out where birds are going are so tiny, you can put them on small birds. Mm-hmm. That's the advantage. But they don't transmit information. We do have satellite tracking devices, and those are used, and they're very informative. But for tiny, tiny birds, they're just too big. And so a little Western sandpiper needs a small tracking unit. And in order to get the information from that tracking unit, you have to catch the bird, put the unit on its leg, then it goes on migration, and then you have to catch it again.
And you'd think that that would be impossible, but it's not, because they come back to the same place,
right? So the next year, after it's returned to a nesting area, let's say in Alaska, you put your mist net, your capturing devices out, you catch the bird in the same place you caught it the year before, because they go back there, and not all of them, but many, many, in fact, most, the vast majority. And then you can remove this tiny device and extract the information and learn where it went during that past year or even longer.
Wow. It's just remarkable. So most birds are nocturnal migrants, right?
Yeah. If you consider the songbirds around here, pretty much all of them, except for, let's say, swallows or a few others, migrate at night. The typical thing is they take off after sunset and fly most of the night, and then they come down. The advantage to that is that they can spend the daylight hours feeding. Like if you're a warbler and you're migrating hundreds of miles each night, you've got to feed. And so
they can also avoid predators that way.
Yeah, and the air is more stable at night. There's cues there for them to follow, of course. The stars are there, so they don't have any trouble figuring out which way to go. And, so nighttime. If you're a soaring bird, though, and you make use of updrafted winds off of a mountain or thermally driven air masses, hot air rising off of a big field, for example, warm air rises, and they use those, like hawks and sandhill cranes will use those. Those birds that need those updrafts migrate during the daytime.
Uh-huh.
But if you just counted up the number of species that day versus night, it'd be mostly nighttime migration.
And especially like the songbirds, the smaller birds are mostly. And a really cool thing to do is to actually set up a scope so that you can watch them cross the moon, right?
Yeah, you can actually see them. When I heard about this, I said, I got to try it.
Yeah.
And I got my scope out, 20-power scope, aimed it at the moon, full moon during the migration season. And like within 30 seconds, I was seeing birds. I was like, holy cow. And you could
see. It's like this hidden world. You just had no idea.
You can sometimes make out what type of bird it is. Maybe not exactly, but that looks like a shorebird, or that looks like something else. And tell which direction they're going. There are a lot of water birds that migrate day or night. So there's some that are very flexible and go either way too.
So how do birds prepare for their journey, and what usually triggers their departure?
All right, so let's consider a bird that's a long distance migrant. So it's not just flying, from here to Whidbey Island, but it's flying hundreds, if not thousands of miles on a leg of its migration. That requires fuel, of course, and the fuel is fat. And so the primary thing that the migrant has to do before it can take off and leave is fatten up. And we're talking about major,
fattening up.
And this is, it ranges in different species, but commonly 1/3 to 1/2 of that bird's body weight will be fat.
That's just astonishing. I mean, it's like us putting on an extra 50 pounds or more.
Yeah. And the odd thing is that these obese birds are super athletes that aren't encumbered by this, but are actually facilitated by having this big fuel supply that they can use. So they eat a lot of food, they select fat-rich foods, and then once they've hit this 30 to 40 to 50% fat level, then they wait for the winds, because winds are important.
But back to food, you were telling me a really cool thing about them eating biofilm, which I had no idea about. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so right now, actually, this is where it was discovered, and it's happening in other places, but we'll use the discovery point up on the Fraser River Delta up in Vancouver, BC, not far from here, go north in the Salish Sea. Big mud flats there, and the sandpipers there, Western sandpipers and Dunlins, lots of sandpipers migrate through there and use those mud flats. And we always assumed they were just eating worms and little crustaceans and little mollusks and things like that. But it turns out that up to half their calories and their food intake up there is this mixture of goop called biofilm that thrives on the tops of these mud flats, and it's bacteria and protozoa, diatoms, little tiny algae, and it just looks like a kind of a greenish frosting. And they have a tongue that has little fringes on it, the sandpipers do, and it helps them lap up this biofilm. And it's an important source of food for them. It's actually high in energy and in omega-3 fatty acids, which are perfect for putting on fat appropriate for fueling a migration. So we're just learning about that, really, and it probably is more widespread than we realize. So that's one of the sources of food for fattening.
Yeah,
for the migration.
That's remarkable. Sorry, I interrupted you. You were telling me that they're triggered by that the wind often triggers their departure.
Yeah, think about it. You know, you're starting out on a flight and you're 50%, 40, 50% fat. You know, it's just makes sense that you're not going to want to fly into a headwind. You know, you're just like all good sailors and pilots, you pay attention to the weather, and the birds do, and they wait for the appropriate wind direction to come up, and then they go. In some places, there's a lagoon in Alaska, on the Alaska Peninsula, where Brant, a little goose that we have that visits Port Townsend every year, there are still some here, but during their southward migration from their nesting areas in the Arctic, they assemble in this lagoon and fatten up, and they wait there several weeks, fattening up, but then they wait for the winds to be right. And in some of the best days up there, 100,000 of these brant, the small goose, will leave on that one day because the weather is right, and off they go.
Uh-huh.
And they're flying.
Like a sailing race.
Yeah, it's R2. AK reversed, R2PT, or BC, yeah. Baja California.
Yeah.
And some of them fly for 3 days nonstop, 3,000 miles to Baja.
Wow.
Others fly not quite that far. They come here to the Salish Sea.
Well, and you have some really interesting stories about seeing banded brants, right?
Yeah. Out of Point Hudson, they spend a lot of time. They're really easily accessible place, and You can sometimes see the banded brant, and I've been photographing those over several years, and I've found, I think, 32 different individuals now, and some of them I've seen in multiple years. They just come back to the same spot each year and use it as a fattening area before they migrate. And one bird in particular, I was sad to learn it died a couple years ago, only about a week after I last saw it alive and well. But I'd seen that bird four different times. And this is just sort of chance encounters. Uh-huh. I don't spend all my day sitting out there watching them. But that bird had just passed its 25th birthday the last time I saw it. And it was coming from Banks Island, which is Arctic Canada. And by the way, brant fly, I calculated that if it spent the winter every year in the Salish Sea, and maybe some years it went to Baja, I'm not sure, but if it just went even just this far, it probably flew over 200,000 miles in its life.
That is just astonishing. How do they do it? Just amazing. So we've got some really cool places where we can see large concentrations of migrants, right? I mean, one of them is Grays Harbor, and hopefully some of our radio listeners were able to get out to the festival. It's usually about the first weekend in May, and they put on this shorebird festival that has lots of events and lectures you can go see. I mean, they're up to 500,000 birds that end up there, right?
Yeah. The western sandpipers and dunlins and many, many other species, but those are the two most numerous ones, pass up the coast here in April and May. And so, Grays Harbor, Willapa Bay, the Fraser River Delta is a good place to go to see those migrating birds. The place where the biofilm was discovered is the important food source. But then for the snow geese, in the wintering season, and they're pretty much have left now, but over in the Skagit and some of the other river deltas on the east side of the Salish Sea is where these snow geese gather, and they're very easily seen. Those snow geese that you see over there have come from, almost all of them have come from Wrangel Island off northeastern Siberia. That's where they nest.
Well,
but they come here to spend the winter in the Salish Sea coast at these river delta mouths. So it's a pretty remarkable place to see a lot of birds.
It looks like we have run out of time once again. We're going to have you back for part three of migration. Thanks so much for coming. And you have a book coming out. It's almost ready for press, right?
Well, it's a book on waterbird migration that I'm working on with my co-authors, Audrey Benedict, who was involved with the Salish Sea book.
And that's a beautiful book for those of you that haven't seen that. It's has gorgeous photos and lots of interesting text.
Yeah, and the book, the waterbird migration book, will look a lot like that. That's the intent of the publisher, to have it look like that. And then another biologist, Rob Butler, who's a shorebird specialist up in British Columbia, is our other co-author. But it's in the editing process now, and we're looking forward to having that come out next spring.
Great. Well, we can hardly wait to see it. So thanks so much for coming to share with
us. Well, thank you. I enjoyed being here with you.
Our interview with Jeff last year, the book has indeed come out, and it's gorgeous. It's called A Pacific Flyway, Waterbird Migration from the Arctic to Tierra del Fuego, and it's hot off the press. I just got a copy of it a couple of weeks ago, and I've been loving it. That's something to look forward to, is to keep your eyes peeled for Jeff's book. And for those of you who missed part one of this interview, please go to the KPTZ archives and search for the podcast. I believe Mary aired it about 3 weeks ago. And here's our mystery sound again. It's a pine siskin, and that lilting shriek call seems to be everywhere in deciduous and coniferous forests these days. So what can you tell us about our delightful pine siskins, Fred?
Well, it's lovely to have these forest denizens back. They're still in their big chattery flocks, moving around, bounding through the forest. They're sort of they're about the size of a goldfinch and kind of sound like a goldfinch. They're actually in the same genus. And these lovely little birds, see them a lot, feeding out on the branch tips of alders, going for the little alder cones. They also love feed on the western red cedar cones that point up in the air. Western hemlocks are also a good species for the tree. Hemlocks are pretty good at producing consistent abundance of seeds from year to year, and so that kind of keeps our siskins in the neighborhood. But they really like the big crops that some of the Douglas firs and true firs produce, and those big seeds, about every 3 or 4 years, we'll get a big flourishing of seeds from these species, and we get lots of siskins in the neighborhood. So it could be one of those springs and summers where these sprightly little birds are dominating the sound acoustic airwaves.
And I've lived in this area for 30 years, and I've never heard so many as this year. And I was trolling through records and not noticing that other people were talking about the abundance of siskins, but I bet you that other people have been noticing the same thing.
Yeah, it seems like we're starting to get a few reports, and you're just easily amused more than most people.
I don't know if our listeners are familiar with Kitchen's great book, Birds of the Olympic Peninsula. I mean, he wrote it back, it was published in 1949, and he wrote it back in the 20s, and he called the siskins the most abundant bird on the Olympic Peninsula, right?
Sure did, yeah. And that was back in the day, still before, of course, a lot of logging had been going on, but there was still a lot more coniferous forests that were intact. The nice thing about a mature or old growth forest is you have these really dense multi-layered canopies with forest gaps that really optimally use the sunshine, the sunny resources, and they're really good at converting the sun's energy into more plant growth and large seed crops. And so back in those ancient forests of yore, there probably was a lot more siskins moving around. But we'll certainly see the siskin's a cool bird because not only do they like older, mature forests, but they can also do pretty well in humanized landscapes. You'll see in breeding right down to sea level, even around our towns and villages and farm valleys where there's lots of thistle seed and a little forest grove nearby where they can nest in. Yeah, they'll often be at our feeders, and they have the little yellow spots on them.
Fred put together a great summary of different birds, and he has a really delightful passage about siskins. It says, siskin is from the Swedish word siska, meaning a chipper, an appropriate appellation for these tiny members of the finch family. Patches of yellow in their otherwise drab plumage provide a hint of the unpredictable and exuberant spirit that lies within. If you've ever heard a flock of them, that they just seem full of joy. That's it for Nature Now for the first week of April. And thanks so much for joining me, Fred. And thanks to Nora for her creative use of recording equipment to get us all on the air while safely social distancing. I also want to thank all of you for listening. Remember, if you missed any of our program or want to listen again, this program will be rebroadcast at 5 p.m. on Thursday, 12:30 on Saturday, and available as a podcast in a week or so at kptz.org. Closing music is 10,000 Miles by Mary Chapin Karp from the lovely film Fly Away Home, based on a true story about a family teaching abandoned goslings to fly and migrate. Wishing you all health and more opportunities than ever to get out and appreciate the wonderful natural world in your own backyard.
I'm going away. But I'll be back. Though I go 10,000 miles. 10,000 miles, my own true love, 10,000 miles or more.